KBSCU's presents The Defense Brickens.
While expounding upon national missile defense, both the Bush-Cheney administration and the mainstream media grant only the public a flippant remark or a cursory analysis about the impact of ballistic missile defense implementation upon international treaties and the global community itself. The one international treaty almost reflexively cited to the masses by the Bush-Cheney administration, while our attention is focused upon the topic of ballistic missile defenses, is the 1972 agreement between the United States and the then Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or USSR, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has called the ABM Treaty a, quote, Cold War relic, end quote. Carl Grossman, a professor of journalism at the State University of New York, explains more.
The ABM Treaty was an understanding, was a treaty made between the Soviet Union and the United States. It's a bilateral treaty, and the object of the treaty was to bring into some order of semblance this whole matter of ballistic missiles. And, a bottom line of the treaty was that we and they could only have two sites where there'd be anti-ballistic missiles. In fact, they ultimately set one up around Moscow. And so it's to limit a runaway situation of more and more missiles and anti-missiles or anti-ballistic missiles and so forth.
Contrary to the opinion of many within the United States government, the global community views the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty differently. Dr. John Steinbrunner, the director of the Center for International and Security Studies at the Maryland School of Public Affairs within the University of Maryland, summarized the world's perspective.
The international community as a whole recognizes the ABM Treaty as a foundation of all the legal agreements.
Retired United States Navy Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll, now the Vice President Emeritus with the Center for Defense Information, posits that even if a ballistic missile defense system was technically and operationally effective, ballistic missile defense deployment may cause more headaches than it would cure.
Many of us question the political outcome of the United States proceeding against the advice of its closest friends and allies and, of course, the complaints of our potential adversaries, in that we could very well end up less secure in a less stable nuclear environment with a national missile defense system than we are today. The reasoning goes this way. Russia and the United States entered into this formal treaty to ban competition in defensive systems. And if we violate that treaty, we pull the foundation out from under all efforts at arms control. There simply is no basis for agreements and reductions under reasonable rules and verification.
If the United States decides to deploy a ballistic missile defense system that could destroy a ballistic missile just after said missile's launch or during the missile's boost phase, as it is termed by specialists, a ballistic missile defense system could render null and void yet another international arms treaty. Carl Grossman with more.
The more important treaty, as far as I'm concerned, is the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. We've certainly been on the verge of breaking its intent. I mean, that treaty, which was around before the ABM Treaty, and that is an international treaty ratified by most of the world's nations, sets space aside for peaceful purposes. And in fact, the U.S. was the leader in enacting the Outer Space Treaty.
One of the drafters of the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, or OST, details the current status of the Outer Space Treaty and how a ballistic missile defense system runs counter to the spirit of the 1967 agreement.
The purpose of the 1967 resolution was to ban weapons of mass destruction in outer space, but its larger intent was to demilitarize space. We saw space at that time as a dangerous area, that is, an area which would be subject to militarization unless the nations of the world acted quickly to demilitarize it, so that the United States, in proposing this, was taking what we felt at the time was a first and important step. The UN is moving in that direction, and in November of this last year, made a resolution which was proposing demilitarizing space, and the United States was only one of three countries to abstain on that resolution. That is, we are increasingly isolating ourselves on that topic, as we are, as you know, in the area of small arms and bacteriological weapons and the Kyoto Protocol and other issues of this sort.
Mike Moore, the senior editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, details the differences between the militarization of space and the weaponization of space.
Space has been militarized since the 1960s. After Sputnik, and this is in the last year's the Eisenhower administration, President Eisenhower came under intense pressure by our military and by other people, including some hardliners and think tanks, to put weapons into space, and he refused to do it. He said that space should be reserved for peaceful purposes. By that, he meant non-aggressive purposes, and from his standpoint, spy satellites were just fine. Surveillance satellites, reconnaissance satellites, warning satellites, and so on, simply gave us information about the Soviet Union, and he believed that both sides should have all the spy satellites they wanted, because that would help reassure them that the other side was not about to strike. But he believed that weapons in space, actual weapons that could destroy other satellites or even hit earthly targets, were very dangerous. It was something we didn't need to do. It's something that should not be done from a simple humanitarian standpoint, and he refused to go along. Now, ever since the Eisenhower years, there have been a lot of people, especially in the Air Force, a few at the Pentagon and at the Air University and so on, who have advocated putting various weapons into space, or at least developing weapons, ground-based weapons, that could be used against satellites in space. Anti-satellite weapons, for instance, were much talked about in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and they're being talked about now. Now, these are weapons that could be fired from the ground and to knock out other people's satellites. Space-based anti-satellite weapons are talked about now. Space-based weapons that would be able to strike earthly targets are being talked about. The chief proponent of weapons in space is Don Rumsfeld, who's now Secretary of Defense. He's been a long time space power partisan, and he chaired a commission last year that looked into the future of military space, and then the commission, which issued its report in January, comes out four square for the need for the United States to begin to weaponize space. And by weaponize space, they mean going whole hog up to and including space-based lasers that could hit satellites and possibly earthly targets.
The 1970 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, may be affected as well. President of the Global Security Institute, Jonathan Granoff, explains the specifics of the 1970 NPT Treaty.
The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is the cornerstone of the non-proliferation regime, is threatened by the Missile Defense Initiative. It's interesting the press keeps focusing on the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which is just a treaty between the United States and the Soviet Union and the successor states to that treaty, which is primarily Russia. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is a treaty with 187 countries in it, and the five declared nuclear weapon states, meaning states that had tested when the treaty went into effect, China, the United Kingdom, France, Russia, and the United States, are part of that treaty. And 182 states have been promised under that treaty by the five nuclear weapon states that in exchange for those 182 states not developing nuclear arsenals, that those five nuclear weapon states would negotiate the elimination of their nuclear weapons. That's the core bargain of the treaty. That's the core of the treaty. And out of that treaty, great progress has been made. Latin America is a nuclear weapons-free zone. Africa is a nuclear weapons-free zone. And there were countries there not only nuclear capable, but going down the road of building nuclear arsenals that changed course based on the bargain of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and did not develop nuclear weapons, did not enter a nuclear arms race. For example, Argentina and Brazil. For example, South Africa, which gave up nuclear weapons and joined the treaty. So virtually every country in the southern hemisphere of the planet Earth is a party to the NPT, and the southern hemisphere is a nuclear weapons-free zone. The treaty is a great treaty. Now, that promise to negotiate the elimination of nuclear weapons cannot be fulfilled if the United States moves forward with a missile defense, because other countries which will be threatened by that system will simply not give up their nuclear weapons. And it breaks, this unilateral step will break the cooperative regime necessary to obtain nuclear disarmament. And that, to me, is the most insidious and stupid part of missile defense. If those 182 countries, if their confidence in that treaty regime is broken, the response of many countries over the long term will be, well, if the United States, with its overwhelming military superiority, claims the need to have nuclear weapons, even though it has all these, even weapons in space and weapons in the oceans and et cetera, and we're poor with resources that are threatened by our neighbors, if the United States is the example, is the leader, then we too better have these weapons of mass destruction.
Now that we have a general understanding of many of the affected international arms agreements, we now turn to how ballistic missile defense implementation will adversely affect them in greater detail. Craig Eisendrath explains.
I think there are a number of them, and I think they're quite serious. I think in the largest sense, if we go ahead unilaterally with national missile defense, we begin to destroy the fabric of international cooperation and an agreement, which has kept the world safe for the last 30 or 40 years. That is very, very serious. What's at risk here is not just the ABM treaty, but the whole fabric of arms control agreements. If that fabric comes unraveled or ripped or torn or whatever metaphor you like, we're in very serious trouble. Because it means that there really is then no international or multilateral restraint on other countries, and by the way, on us as well. So that's the biggest danger. There is a danger, as I mentioned, of an arms race resulting from national missile defense. There's also a danger that the Russians will, for instance, feel unconstrained by any of these agreements and begin to, you know, use possibly intermediate range missiles again, begin to put nukes on ships, begin to use multi-reentry vehicles where they're presently prohibited, and so forth. It isn't just a question of them adding or subtracting nukes, it's also a question of them using in various forms which have been prohibited. They'll also feel much less constraint on the proliferation of technology, both with missiles and nuclear weapons. All that becomes unstuck if we begin to act unilaterally. That's what I think is the biggest danger. Once a country assumes the prerogative of violating one of these treaties, it really opens the door to any country doing the same. That is, the Russians have told us that it will consider the arms control regime as null and void if we violate unilaterally one of its key elements. That's why it's very dangerous. It will give, for instance, license to the Chinese and the Russians to spread information about the building of national missile defense systems or nuclear systems, any country it chooses. It will free the Russians to go back on a number of treaties which it signed over the last 25 or 30 years. That's its danger. It's not just the ABM treaty, but it's the entire arms control regime which is at stake.
Jonathan Dean discusses the connection between defensive and offensive ballistic missile systems.
We already see what the effects of the missile defense on the ABM treaty are. The Bush administration has the fixed intention of abrogating the treaty, nullifying, withdrawing from the treaty. That's why I don't think that possible agreement that Presidents Putin and Bush reached at Genoa to discuss missile defense and reductions of arsenals together is going to amount to anything. Russia wants to have the ABM treaty continued in some form, even if an attenuated form, because it rightly understands that combining defenses with offense increases the power of the offense. This has been true ever since the Romans or the Greeks developed body armor for their soldiers. And so they fear an increase in American defenses over the years until it is capable of dealing with their own arsenal, and which would place the United States in a position to, if they wish to launch a surprise attack on Russia with relative impunity, because the Russians wouldn't have much left to respond with. And that even if it never took place, that creates a situation of domination of one country over the other, which is very unpleasant. And the same is true for China. That's the reason for their probable increase in those circumstances. The ABM treaty is a very valuable treaty. It is a recognition by the United States and Russia at that time, Soviet Union at that time, that if you want to limit the offense, you have to limit the defense. You have to limit both in order to get some control and get both coming down. If you leave one unlimited, it will increase and serve as a dynamic motivation for increases in the other.
Dr. John Steinbrenner explores the manner in which ballistic missile defense implementation could destabilize the international arena.
It has two effects that are really of grave concern. One is that a violation or abrogation or violation of this treaty is a unilateral change of what the world considers to be fundamental rules. And the fundamental rules in this case are, in the first instance, a procedural principle, which was originally stated in the treaty that said there is to be no defensive deployment except by mutual agreement. So it's acknowledging that other countries have a legitimate stake in what we do and a legitimate right to participate, if you will, in the relevant decisions. And the United States is threatening to violate not only the treaty but that principle. And that's not just a matter of abstract principle, because what we're doing represents a potentially very severe threat to other countries. We're not just deploying or proposing to deploy defensive systems. We're proposing to do so in conjunction with offensive forces that have much more advanced capability than anybody else's. And the combination implicitly presents a preemptive threat to countries, because they can recognize actually that the defensive system we propose to deploy would not work against an offense that can initiate the conditions of attack and not be damaged before it does so. But it might work against an offense that had been first attacked by the United States. And so what they recognize is implicitly a very severe threat that is not being subjected to legal restraint, and that combination is frightening. In the first instance, to countries like Russia and China, who, although not considering themselves to be enemies, do recognize that it is imaginable that they would be involved in military confrontation with the United States under circumstances that they could not control. Beyond that, it's frightening to literally anybody who might encounter that situation of confrontation with superior U.S. military forces. This is really promises to be an element of intimidation, and naturally enough, a good part of the world is worried about that. So the thought that the United States will pursue decisive military advantage without legal restraint is very, very disturbing to potential enemies and allies alike. And in my view, it is severely threatening, actually, to the real security interests of the United States itself.
This news feature contains segments from interviews with retired United States Navy Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll, now the Vice President Emeritus with the Center for Defense Information, former Ambassador Jonathan Dean, now an advisor on international security issues with the Union of Concerned Scientists, Senior Fellow at the Center for International Policy, Craig Eisendrath, President of the Global Security Institute, Jonathan Granoff, Carl Grossman, a Professor of Journalism at the State University of New York, Mike Moore, the Senior Editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and Dr. John Steinbrunner, the Director of the Center for International and Security Studies at the Maryland School of Public Affairs within the University of Maryland. All of the featured interviews occurred during the last week of July and continued through the first week of August in 2001. The featured music is by the band Scorn. The tracks are Exodus and Dream Space, respectively, from their 1994 LP, Evanescence. That's it for this program. You've been listening to one part in 10 of the KVSC News feature series, The Defense Pretense, a critical look at proposed missile shields. Reporting for KVSC FM News, I'm Jed Cousin.
Beast.